Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host. And let's see, we have an announcement. But first of all, I'll tell you, Alejandro Rojas is coming up in just a minute. And our guest this evening, I'm really excited to talk to, his name is Lauren Christensen. He was a police, he's been in the military, and then he was a police officer for 20 years. He has some great stories and some other stories from other police officers. We're going to be talking about all that later on. First of all, the announcement. Pardon me. It's going to be good news for some of you live listeners. It's going to be bad news for some of you live listeners. I do get a lot of email people wishing that I'd be a little bit earlier if they're in Europe. They want to listen live. So they'll be happy. I'm moving to a new day that may affect some live listeners as well. Pardon me. I'm going to go to starting June 5th, which is a Tuesday. I'm going to be moving to Tuesday. And then I'm going to be going at 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Now, I can probably hear some boos and nays and some people saying yay as well out there. So that only affects the live listener. It's really not going to affect anyone at all that listens to the podcast. It's just going to be out a day earlier. That's about it. Everything else will remain the same. So that's it for the announcement. Alejandro Rojas, welcome to the show.
That is
I. You're not on video again. Yes.
Yeah, sorry, guys. Yeah, we've got, well, those who, I guess, listen to my show, including yourself, would know that there's some kind of construction going on and stuff here at the house. That is the reason why. I apologize for that, but I don't know. I look the same as I did last time you could see me on video, so not much difference.
That's right, yeah. So what's going on in the world of UFOs this week?
So what's going on? There's a lot going on as far as, not a lot of big news. I think, you know, the reason I'm pausing is because I think my story on the Den of Geek is kind of big news in a way. And it's, I don't know if I've talked about this during your show, but the story I finally got out that I had printed, and it was a tip off that Elizondo had given me about politicians talking about the possibility of congressional hearings on UFOs. And so it's really, really interesting stuff.
Now, I don't believe we have talked about that, actually.
Okay, cool, because I was probably waiting until this came out. So this is really cool. Politico wrote about this, which is really neat. So what happened is a few weeks ago, there was a science space conference, and it was a big conference with politicians, you know, NASA, defense. It's this big space conference that goes on, and there was some news that came out of it. But the Politico started this space briefs kind of news thing that they're going to do every week. And it's a long, you know, kind of almost newsletter where there's several stories and, like, you know, a dozen or so different stories about space. They're short stories. Well, in one of these, if you scrolled all the way down, they were talking about this conference. And the Politico writer who is writing this, you know, newsletter, asked some politicians about UFOs. So it's kind of cool. So the guy's name is Bender. He's Brian Bender. He's a defense editor, but also writes about space and stuff like that. And at this conference, they were doing some panels, and Politico had a whole thing of panels. And during one of these panels, I think I might have even put a link to the actual videos, but there were some people there. There was a Democrat, Ami Berra is his name. He's a guy, actually. A Republican, Randy Holtgren. President and CEO of the Coalition for Deep Space Exploration, Mary Lynn Dittmar. She's also an advisor to the Space Council that Trump just recently set up for advice on, you know, direction for NASA and stuff like that. And Berra and Holtgren are both members of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. And Berra is actually a ranking member of the subcommittee on space. So Bender told the panel, he said, you know, you hear these reports. We've been hearing about them for decades. Other countries take it more seriously than government researchers here do. You know, when it comes to UFOs, should we be doing more? Is this just kind of crazy sci-fi stuff? And, you know, typically on a panel like this, you know, everybody would get nervous and kind of make some jokes or something like that. But Barra, the guy who's on the space committee, said, we ought to bring some folks in. He said he found that news really had piqued his interest. He said he actually talked to the chairman of the subcommittee, meaning the space subcommittee, Brian Babin, as well as another chairman of the entire, you know, space and science committee. And he said, we ought to have hearings on this, right? We ought to have some people look into this. He said, look, if you want to boost C-SPAN ratings, you know, a lot of people would be interested. But he said, we don't know what these phenomena are. Obviously, it's important enough to allocate some funds, and we ought to talk about what we can talk about. So really interesting statement. Now, Hultgren, the other guy who's on the technology committee, he said it also piqued his interest, and he also said it gets people engaged. And he says, I don't think this should be a primary priority, but certainly we should get some answers. And Dittmar, who's part of that coalition and an advisor for the space committee, Trump space committee, says, if there really are things buzzing around in the skies we don't understand, then we certainly should take a look at it. So, pretty shocking. I mean, this guy says he himself, when he read the New York Times article, had gone to the committee chair and said, hey, we should have some congressional hearings on this. So now we know, you know, these conversations are happening because of that New York Times article. And like I said, it was actually a link that Elizondo had sent me. He's like, look, you know, we're gaining some ground. And this is the type of thing, you know, that's, I think, why we're not hearing from him so much and the rest of the group. Because this is what surprising, I think they're even surprised on how much traction they're getting in the mainstream world on this news that the Department of Defense has looked into this topic. And Elizondo and the pilots who have come out and talked, you know, are very credible. They come across very well. And I mean, they're having a significant impact, I think, as far as the credibility of this phenomenon.
Wow. I just was asked to do a talk at the Illinois MUFON meeting they're having this coming Sunday, a little weekend conference. Sam Maranto, good friend, contacted
me. Yeah, he's great.
He wants me to talk about what impact the Pentagon, you know, the New York Times article basically had. So I'm definitely going to be talking about this information. That is really that's really great momentum, actually.
Mm-hmm. It's on the Den of Geek. So I will provide, you know, a little bit of an outline on Open Minds eventually, but probably nothing more than you can get at Den of Geek. So definitely, please do go to Den of Geek and check it out. And the reason I think it's also really important that you go there is that Den of Geek, and like you've noted, is huge. I mean, they're one of the top visited sites, period, in the U.S.
country.
Yeah, in the entire country.
Like, it's rated 2,000 out of, like, hundreds of millions of websites. Mm-hmm. So that's really...
So they get tons of viewers. And in my last story where I asked Scott Kelly about UFOs, it created tons of conversation in their comments. And when you go look at it, you can see this is not the typical audience. This is not just the ufologists. It's all of these millions of people out there who have you know, varying interests. Mm-hmm. So that's what's cool about this site, getting to all of these new audience. But there was a lot of commentary that happened. My Scott Kelly story last weekend was the number one story of the weekend. So it shows, you know, just that there's a lot of people. Me and my buddy Chris Longo, who's an editor there, you know, he really championed wanting to get more UFO stories on there because he also felt, you know, the public was really interested in the topic. And now the editors are really excited because they see that is the case. So this is also an opportunity for people that listen to our shows who are more familiar with this topic to get in and make some comments, you know, share some information and share your knowledge and your insight into this topic with some of those people reading these stories. So It'll only help to spread even more credible information. So please do go to Den of Geek and check it out. Plus, they've got lots of fun stories. I'm sure many of our listeners are into sci-fi, and that's their main genre that they cover there.
Yeah, yeah. Excellent. So what else is, I mean, that's pretty major, but what else is happening?
Yeah, otherwise, I mean...
any sightings going on?
What's that?
Any interesting sightings that you're aware of?
Well, not personally that I've seen recently, but there was, I think this is really interesting. NASA came out with a big piece of news just the other day, Monday, and they said that there were evidence of plumes from Jupiter's moon Europa of water. So we've all heard about, you know, Europa, this ice planet, and this may be a possibility. But NASA is saying that, you know, even more likely that there is water. And what's interesting, of course, is we're hearing more and more stories of these of evidence or that, you know, it's more and more likely that there is life, you know, in right here in our solar system on other planets or moons. And so we keep getting this news, and NASA is extremely excited about it, especially this news that they just released Monday about Europa. And so very fun. I think this is significant, too, because I think it helps also to when the public sees, you know, scientists telling people that we're on the cusp of discovering, you know, microbial life out there that, you know, that's only one step away from, you know, if our solar system has life throughout it, even if it is, you know, bacteria or microbes or something like that, then the probability that there is intelligent civilization, intelligent life out there is also enhanced. And so this all, I think, plays to what, of course, our interest is and why we do these shows that, you know, this is much more credible than important topic than the public has realized throughout the years.
Yeah. You know, I think as things progress here, I think it's going to be less and less of a reaction in the general public and society once it comes out. Yes, there's definitely microbial life, or I think it's going to, you know, I think it'll be just really big news, and then everyone will just accept it. I think that's where we are at this point. I don't believe that we're at the point where, you know, religions are going to fail and, you know, the catastrophes that have been warned about. I don't think any of that's going to happen. I don't believe so anymore.
I think you're exactly right. And I think that we're seeing that even with the major media. It's not like, whoa, you know, holy crap, this is real. It's more like, yeah, you know, we always thought it possibly could be, even though we made fun of it. You know, we thought it could be possible. And now it's turning out, you know, more and more that it is possible and it is a reality. So I think you're right. They talk about that when we're all faced with, you know, unknown events, that the first stage is to completely deny it, the second stage is to kind of make fun of it, and then the third stage is to accept it as a foregone conclusion. Mm-hmm. And it isn't with a big bang, a big holy, oh my gosh, you know, we're freaking out. It's more of a, sure, of course, we knew that all the time, you know.
Yeah.
So it's interesting times, but it makes it more fun, I think, because it makes it... it gives us more of a wider venue to talk to people about this. So, for instance, you know, when I went to that event, and there was a little bit of nervous laughter when I asked Scott Kelly about UFOs, because it's, you know,
I heard that.
He's like a hero. Yeah, you could hear it in the audio, and everybody's like, you know, and I was expecting some people to be like, oh my gosh, how could you ask that? But not really. Even though people were a little nervous, the reaction of the PR people I was with and some of my fellow colleagues who are, you know, media people was very positive. They thought, wow, it's cool. You know, it's more like, hey, it was cool you asked that, you know, it was brave of you, more of, and it was something that I should have done. I didn't get the response at all. Like, I kind of was even expecting that. Oh, how dare you do that? You know? So it's really cool. I think people are really opening up to this as being an okay topic to talk about. And I think that that's only going to be good. I think we'll be able to discover more together.
Right, right, exactly. All right, Alejandro. Well, hey, thanks a lot. And we'll be having you on next week, right? You are coming on next week.
I'll be here. Yeah, I will be here because soon after that, I'll be going to the Utah UFO Fest. So people maybe can go see me out there in Cedar City, I think it's called, in Utah.
Huh. All right. Well, hey, thanks a lot. And I'll talk to you
next week. All right, talk to you soon, buddy.
All right, bye. Take care. Bye. All right, everyone, our guest this evening is Lauren Christensen. He is he's a great author. He's championed over 50 books, close to 60, and he's been involved in law enforcement since 1967, a 21-year-old military policeman in the U.S. Army, and he was also in Saigon, Vietnam. In 26, he joined the Portland, Oregon Police Bureau, and so he basically, after 25 years, retired and started writing books, and one right after the other, and we're going to be talking about a real interesting book. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Good day. Glad to be here.
Yes. And you are in, you're over in Oregon still, not too far from Portland. And so you kind of settled there, and I don't hear a lot about UFOs in Portland. Do you pay attention to any of that?
Well, I think wasn't Rainier one of the first sightings in the United States, and Rainier is just a short drive up I-5.
Yeah, but I mean,
that's
actively
all I know about
now,
here.
do you hear?
No,
you don't hear.
And then McMinnville, which is a small town, it's about 30 minutes from. It's about 40 minutes from Portland. That was a major sighting too.
Right.
They have a big. Actually, I think it's this weekend. They have a UFO festival there. They make a big. It's more fun than it is scary. But I guess they have speakers in some kind of auditorium. I haven't been to it, but they have. It's kind of a combination of information and a lot of fun. People dress up like aliens and they parade around and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think Peter Davenport usually goes to that too. Have you ever actually gone to that?
I went one time just because I have a daughter that lives down there, and we just went to the parade. We didn't go to any. I didn't even know there were any talks. I would have.
Yeah. Okay. So you are someone that's kind of outside of the UFO field for the most part. You're not someone that does the circuit and stuff like that. And I love the fact that you're a police officer and military police. And I want to talk quite a bit about that. But can you give the listening audience basically your background and just so they can learn who you are?
I grew up in Vancouver, Washington, which is right across the Columbia River from Portland. Went into the Army in 1967. I did 2 years stateside, one in Florida, where I had the major UFO incident that I'll talk about later. And then from there, I went to Washington, D.C. and studied the Vietnamese language, and then went over to Vietnam as a patrolman in Saigon. And if I may plug a book, I just had a book come out called Policing Saigon. Just came out a couple of weeks ago. I did a year there, which was about the a year there was approximately the same as 25 years with any major city in the United States. Saigon at that time was considered the most dangerous city in the world. Hmm. Anyway, I did a year there and came back. I didn't want anything to do with police work. I went back into the martial arts, and one of my old sparring partners was a Portland police officer. He talked me into taking the test. I took it, and I got hired and did 25 years there, retired in 1997.
Ah, and in your policing, do you personally... I think your first story kind of talks about something unusual happening, right, in your book to yourself?
Yeah, it didn't happen to me. Yeah. It happened to you're talking about a book called Cops: True Stories of the Paranormal.
Yeah,
in which there's some UFO stuff and some mutilated cattle stories and that sort of thing. Yeah, I had two or three experiences on the job, and about 2.5 years ago, I started thinking about some of those experiences. I met a woman who had been on the police department in Virginia, and I can't remember the city now. She told me a couple of her stories, and I started thinking, I wonder how many stories are out there. And I thought I'd just put out on Facebook. I belong to a couple of police Facebook pages. And I was a little nervous about doing it because cops are what I call really meat and potatoes. You know, it's all about the evidence. And you say you saw a ghost, they go, well, yeah, okay. A little too much pressure there for you, you know, kind of thing. And I put word out and expected a lot of criticism, and I didn't get any. In fact, the very first day, I put out a request for stories, told them what I was doing. And I'm sort of known in the police community because I have a couple of books that are popular with police officers. And so I had a little trust factor there going on. And my very first day, I got a letter. I got a story from one of the top police trainers in the United States. He trains internationally as well, but he's very well known in the United States. He had already written it up. He was a writer and had already written it up. He hadn't used it any place yet. Sent me the story. So I used him as a sort of a support to request more stories. Then they started coming in. And officers were starting to tell each other. One officer would tell another guy. Some of the people who contacted me were giving me stories. Would say, I know another cop who had an incident happen, and he's more than willing to tell it. And I go, sure. And so I started getting the stories coming into me. And what I would do is I would look at the story. If I liked the story, I would tell them, okay, let's work on this. I would sometimes it just came in notes. I got a couple of snail mail stories written longhand. And my old timers had long retired. And so I would take those stories and I'd rewrite them to fit the format that I wanted for the book. I would send it back to them for them to okay or say, no, this it wasn't quite this way, or I remember another part of this. We do that back and forth, and sometimes it took five or six times until we had a story that was a finished product. Mm-hmm. And I got, I don't know how many stories in there, I think, I don't know how many stories in there, probably over 20, I think, from about 17 different officers from a couple in the military. Most of them are sheriff deputies, SWAT people. And not only are some police officers or were police officers, some are high ranking officers in the military. One was a Navy commander, as I recall. So these all, to use, the other man who was talking, a word that I really liked was they were very credible. And there's only a couple of stories I get. No, I don't think about, I don't think so. Or one, story was so, the guy did some things I thought would, because of what his experience was, he did some things that I thought would get him in trouble with his police agency. And I just said, no, I don't want to use that story. And he was okay with it. He had another story that was fine. But so and then a book came out, I think it was April 2 years ago. And within a couple of weeks, it was a bestseller. It was a bestseller for quite a while. And this bestseller rank is given by Amazon. Mm-hmm. And then it's now it still sells really well, but it's not a bestseller status.
Yeah,
it is. It spikes up there around Halloween, I've noticed.
Let's see. Someone wants to know in the chat room if have you ever had any notable arrests? That's an interesting question. It's kind of a little off topic.
I arrested the leader of the Guardian Angels.
Oh, wow.
And he was a protest here, and he was involved in the protest, and he resisted. And I whispered, I've been practicing martial arts for 53 years. I whispered in his ear, I said, he's a real big guy. He's probably 220, real solid. And I said, you got to get up, because the cameras were all rolling. You know, I whispered in his ear, get up or I'm going to give you some pain. He says, do what you got to do. We got our roles to play. I said, okay. So I'm on national news making him jump up there real quick. And but we ended up had a real nice chat at the back at the precinct. Nice guy. And he had his heart in the right place. But he had to be arrested to show to make his point on the issue.
I see. Yeah. So Getting back to police officers in general, what would you consider makes a MP or a police officer or another type of law enforcement, what makes them good observers or credible witnesses, in your opinion?
Well, from day one in the police academies, they're taught to observe. It's all about observing. And you're taught in lectures, you're taught in exercises in the academy. And then once you get out in the field, you work with a training coach. They might call them different. They might have different titles at different police agencies. In my agency, it was a coach, and you're on probation for about 18 months. And the first year of that, you work with a series of training coaches. And it's all about being taught how to observe, to look for something that's out of the norm. You look into a crowd, I work downtown a lot, so there's lots and lots of people on the street all the time. So there becomes a certain pattern how people move, how they stand, how they drink their lattes, all of this sort of thing. And when something catches your eye that just isn't quite right, this guy's moving a different way, he's dressed in an overcoat on a 95 degree day, you just give him a little more visual attention until you're satisfied, okay, that guy's fine, and then you just move on. So it's all about observing, looking for something that's out of the norm, just watching people, watching hands. I did a lot of bodyguarding for dignitaries that came into Portland. And a quick story is a little bit off the topic, but it'll give you an idea about observation. I bodyguarded Billy Graham for a week. And I'd pick him up at his hotel and take him to the stadium. And I'd stand right down, right below his podium, where my head was about level with his feet. And we had spotters up in high towers. We had people wandering through the crowd and that sort of thing. There's crowd was probably 25,000 people. I had a little earpiece, you know, very James Bond. And we had a spotter said, we got a guy to the six, you're 6 o'clock, you know, police talk. He doesn't look right. And so I'm looking out in the crowd, and the people were either, you know, joyous, or they're laughing, or they were, you know, all engaged in the moment, or they were kind of shuffling to the right or shuffling to the left. And I immediately spotted this guy. He was in a whole different zone in his head. You could tell. And he would, when the crowd would move this way, he'd move the opposite way. He would look down. Everybody was looking up. And the tower people were watching him, and they said, do we have spotters nearby? And anyway, the spotters in the crowd came, and they nabbed the guy, pulled him out of the crowd, and they found a gun on him. He was going to shoot Billy Graham. He was trying to work his way up to the podium. We never let the press know that, but they know it now, I guess. But that just shows that it's all about you're looking for something that's out of the norm, and it's something you really can't teach in the academy. It's something you get by experience. It's one of those things, you know it when you see it, kind of thing. So.
Yep. And what about, you know, someone asked in the chat room, who do you report to if you're a police officer, like if you saw a UFO? But also along those lines, it's you also consider, a police officer considers their reputation before they're reporting something and what's going to happen to them, right?
Well, again, it's the... the cops are meat and potatoes, and it's all about the evidence. Mm-hmm. So there's a couple, three stories in the book, and then one of them's mine, in which the supervisor said, don't put that part of what happened into your report.
Yeah.
In my case, my partner and I experienced a really bizarre thing at a burglary of a coffee shop that we were doing. We were investigating, and had a very strange experience there. And we got back out in the car and we said, we can't put that in the report.
Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Mine?
Yeah.
It was a coffee shop downtown in what's called Old Town. And it used to be Skid Row, and the city's trying to gentrify it and trying to get cutesy little shops and restaurants in there. But meanwhile, you still have dopers and winos and stuff staggering around. But so some of these shops would come and go. This particular one was a coffee shop right on a corner. And my partner and I hadn't been in it yet. We'd go into the new businesses, just introduce ourselves and tell them, you know, we're around all the time and that sort of thing. We hadn't introduced ourselves to this guy yet, but we got a call right out of leaving the precinct. And we went to the coffee shop and we both said, oh, yeah, we haven't been to that place yet. And it was the call came out as a burglary of a business with suspicious circumstances. And we get there, and a man is standing outside of the restaurant. He's got his arms crossed, and he's just really shaky, and he's real jittery. And I said, I wonder if that's our complainant. I get out of the car and ask him, did you call? And he didn't say anything. And I kind of touch his shoulder. I said, did you call? And he kind of looks at me like he didn't know I'd been standing there for, 30 seconds. And he goes, oh, yeah, the police. Yes, please come in. So we went into his little place, and it was, it was a corner place. I think there were two tables, a counter where you bought your stuff, and a counter where you could sit and look out at the windows at the drunk staggering by. So it only seated about, it was a place where businesses would come in, grab their coffee and their donut and leave. But we went into the place, and as we walked in, I noticed he had a metal door that covered the main door with all kinds of locks up and down it. And there were two major windows on each side of the corner, and they had bars all the way up. It's almost like a jail. And as we passed in, I noticed my partner looking, and I was looking. We didn't see any pry marks on the door, which you usually see, where they pry the lock or they jimmy the door facing or something. We go in, and we start talking to the guy, and I look down, and I could see a stack of coffee cups. And there's a little pyramid of coffee cups, and they were probably six or eight across on all four sides, and then seven, and then six, five, four, all the way up to one single coffee cup at the top. And I go, I'm just kind of looking at it going, what the, he looks, he's me looking at it, and he says, I didn't do that. I said, what do you mean you didn't do that? He says, I came in this morning, those cups were that way. I said, maybe the burglar did it. And he said, maybe, but there's no way a burglar got in here. You saw the door. I saw you looking at the door. I have a double. There's no back door. This is it. He says, I stay until 9 o'clock. I clean up. I set up the cups on the shelf over there. He made a point of pointing out, not on the floor. And he said, I don't know. And he says, scared me. And then he looks over and he says, I didn't do that. And I looked over and I could see a couple of two pots of coffee cooking. He says, I didn't make the coffee. Yeah. And he said, I make the coffee. We got there, it was about 15 after 8. He said, I make the coffee about 9:30. I open about 9:45 for the business's first coffee breaks, so they come in. I said, the coffee pots were relatively full, so they hadn't boiled down. They were steaming, but they hadn't boiled down. And so we looked around. There's no place for the guy to hide. His last thing he does is stack the cups on the shelves, so he's behind the counter. There's no place to hide back there. And even if there were a burglar, it's not uncommon for burglars to stay in the place and then break out of the place after they get their stuff, after closing hours. But there was no sign of breaking out. There was no sign of breaking in. And so out in the car, my partner and I should say, some of your listeners might be familiar with this, we have the Portland underground tunnels. A couple of the Ghost Hunter TV shows have come to Portland and gone down in these tunnels. These tunnels were created back in the 1800s when that whole area was just a rock and rolling shoot 'em up taverns and saloons and all that kind of thing. And they'd get a drunk guy, get him drunk, and they'd take him to a trap door in the back of the tavern, drop him down into the tunnel, and he'd be whisked out to a ship on the Willamette River and take it. He'd wake up out in the sea and discover it. Now he's a sailor, So there's been, it was a den of prostitutions. There were murders down there. A cop way back in the turn of the last century got decapitated down there. They found his body, never found his head. Yes. So this place was right next to those tunnels. It was probably 75 feet from the tunnels. In fact, there was a sign out there that said tours you know, weekends, Saturdays or whatever. So my partner and I got in a car and we said, we can't write this up about all these mysterious cups and a coffee pot and everything. We'll just say,
was there no sign of, was there anything missing at all?
No.
So yeah. But the guy we, called it a burglar.
Yeah, wow. We just call it. Well, it is. It's a breaking in, you know.
But, breaking in, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, well, but even that, it wasn't a breaking in because there's no sign of breaking in. It's impossible to break into the place. It's, you had dynamite, you know.
Yeah, wow. Isn't that crazy? So so what did you end
up
doing?
That's a case of us.
Did you
end up? That's a case of us not. Yeah, we just wrote a report, burglary, no sign of no sign of forced entry, unknown suspects. And it just got filed someplace.
About that. Someone wanted me to ask you this in the chat room. Do you know about the mysterious Columbia River UFO incident with police recordings back in 1981?
Wow, I don't. You don't, and I was on that. Then.
That'll give you something to do after the show.
Yeah, I was on then too.
Yeah, yeah. So I want you to talk about, because I had I have a friend, I haven't talked to him in quite a while, but was a police officer, and I want you to talk about the first story. I think it's may not be the first story, but it's called Vanished. Can you tell the listening audience about what happened?
It's the first story in Cops True Stories of the Paranormal. I have it broken into four sections, stuff that happened on patrol, incidents that happened in haunted places, divine intervention, and a small section on UFOs. The first one is the on patrol, and as you said, it's called Vanishing. This happened in Virginia, and I can't remember the city.
Roanoke.
It's in the book. I can't remember the city.
Roanoke. Roanoke. Yeah.
Yeah. Roanoke. And there's two officers who went on to be detectives and are now retired and are still, to use the cliche word, are very haunted about this incident. And they've talked with psychologists, they've talked with their pastors. One guy's very religious. They talk about their pastors. They were working in a neighborhood. They were in an old beater van. This happened way back, so it was probably like a 1970s van. And they were working a series of burglaries in this neighborhood. And so they were just patrolling, just driving around in this old van, plain clothes, just seeing if they could see any suspicious cars or anything. And sure enough, I don't know if it's the first night or the 10th night. I don't remember. I don't know if they even put it in the story, but they spotted this old, what they call a profile car. And just, what's that car doing here? This car doesn't look right. 2 a.m, driving 3 mph down this dark street. They made the car. The guy in the car made them. How they made them, I don't know. He took off at a high speed. The van took off at a high speed as fast as it could go, his old beater van. And they reached some pretty good speeds, 80 miles an hour or so. And they worked their way to a railroad yard in which there was a large tunnel with a cement ring around the outside of the tunnel. The tunnel went 100 feet or so in, just a tracks. The car, for whatever reason, the guy lost control and he hit that cement ring. He hit it so hard and so fast that the car went up. It's like in the movies. When I see it happen in the movies, I go, yeah, that never happens. But if this happened, hit that so hard, the car went up a couple of feet, crashed back down on the ground. They bailed out of the van, or they were trying to get their van stopped. And the driver leaps out the driver's window and takes off into the tunnel. The guys bail out of the van and they start giving foot pursuit through the tunnel. They're really running fast through the tunnel. They got within just almost reaching grabbing distance. You can see the fiber on the guy's clothes and the guy disappeared. He just vanished in front of them. They're hitting everything with their flashlight. You know, some of those tunnels, they have little doors where the guy step out, and there were little docks within. This didn't have anything. It was just smooth cylinder of cement that ran however far it ran to the end. And they'd only chased him about a third of the way in, half the way in or so. They looked all around. There's no place. There's nothing to look at. So they go back out of the tunnel. Now, those other police cars are rolling up. And they walk by the smoldering car. They look in, and the guy's behind the steering wheel, dead. Steering wheel's punched through his chest.
Same guy.
Same guy. The sergeant comes and they're just shaken. I said, that's the guy we chased in the tunnel. And the sergeant said, you can't ride it up that way. you had a foot chase. You had a car chase and the guy crashed and that's the end of the story. You know, you can't put that in a report. So,
all right, now I got to tell you a story. Okay. This is really interesting. I kind of lost contact with a friend, but he was basically, it was a couple that was friends of my ex-wife, and he was a police officer in a town called Northampton, New Hampshire. And he told me this story. He said, you're not going to believe what happened to me the other night. And I said, what happened? He said, I think the road's Lovering or something like that road. And it was all marsh on both sides, just all marsh and wetlands and everything. He was driving along and he saw this teenage girl walking, kind of like a solemn look on her face, just walking like toward him. And so he stopped and he said, you know, it's a runaway. That's what it is, basically. And so he took his floodlight out, and as soon as he stepped out of the car, instantly she vanished. He didn't see her anywhere. He looked all along. He took his floodlight, took his flashlight, went along the marsh, looked everywhere. There was no sign of anywhere. And it's like a big field on both sides, but wet, you know, wetland. So he's shaking his head. He said, how can this happen? He gets back in his car and he has a call. And he said, there's an accident. And he was the closest cop on duty to the accident. So he goes to the accident. He said it was a station wagon smashed up against a stone wall in a tree. And he pried the door open. He looked in, and it was the same girl.
Oh, man. Almost the same deal.
It's almost very close. I read that story, and I said, I got to tell this story.
Well,
yeah.
Well, I often get asked what surprised me about some of the stories in a book, and it's the this vanishing thing, because there's a couple more stories, and I put in some news stories also. At the end of each section, I put in other news stories that I found that happened to cops on patrol or in haunted places, that sort of thing. And I found one, maybe two other vanishing kinds of news stories, as well as the other stories that some of the officers told. That never ever occurred to me. They said, when I get asked, what's the most surprising thing, it's that. You know, it makes me think, when you pass people on the street, you don't always look back at them. Maybe if you did, they wouldn't be there.
So I'm kind of saving your UFO story because it's a great story. I want you to tell it in great detail when we get to it. But I had Bobby, who's a regular listener to the show, usually comes in late. He wanted to know, what's the strangest thing you saw or know about on your tour in Vietnam? Is there anything to talk about?
Well, I had a little ESP thing I didn't put in the book. If I do a second book, and I've gathered a few stories for a second book, I keep getting distracted with other writing projects. But I had an ESP experience, which was kind of weird. I don't fancy myself as being an ESP person, and my mother was, but I never thought I was. I did write, when I saw that as a possible question, I remember reading several years ago, I mean, way back, not too long after I got back, of helicopter pilots. I don't remember if it was just one pilot or more than one, flying over the jungle somewhere and seeing an image in front of them in the air, and giving some kind of signal. And again, my memory, I just don't remember. I could have, if I thought I was going to be asked this before, I'd have looked it up. But the image giving some kind of a warning, either pointing down or whatever the gesture was. And the helicopter either took it as, get off this trajectory, because there's a, you know, a VC, North Vietnamese, gun installment installation down there of some kind, or the helicopter lowered. Maybe the gesture was such that he went down and found some American troops that were stranded. They had no radio. The radio had been destroyed, and he was able to rescue those. I can't remember. It was one of those outcomes, probably hardly worth remembering. That's the only thing I remember about Vietnam.
Now, I know that I have talked to other people where there has been a lot of, there were a lot of UFO sightings in Vietnam. I've talked to a number of people. But I'm sure, you know, that's the last thing on your mind when you're just trying to survive. And like you said, you were in Saigon. So,
well, it wouldn't surprise me yet, but what little I know about UFOs is that sometimes they're attracted to certain kinds of events, aren't they? Like volcanic eruptions, that sort of thing.
Yep.
And here you have a guy where, here you have a place where not only, you know, 58,000 Americans died, but he had 2 million Vietnamese died as well, you know, and I don't know how many from other countries. So there's a lot of tragedy, a lot of violence that went on there for the 10 years we were there, but also the years the French were there, you know, in the 50s, late 50s.
Yeah, they, and, they started it, right? Basically.
Yeah, and then, you know, I think the Japanese even did some stuff there, you know, in the 40s. So, it would not surprise me that such a horrific place would get some kind of UFO sighting of some kind.
Now, did you ever pay any attention to the Rendlesham Forest incident when that came out?
No, I just took a quick peek and I heard about it and I just took a peek and read it online, but I don't.
Yeah. So it didn't really have, at the time, it wasn't anything that sparked your interest at all.
No, just when you told me about it earlier, that's when I looked.
Yeah.
And I
didn't
have time to really read much about it. So,
yeah. Let's talk about, like I said, I want to save your UFO show for, well, actually, the UFO story. For the 1 hour listeners, I think it's probably fair. We probably ought to start talking about it. So I want you to tell in great detail, if you would, your UFO encounter of the second kind.
Well, when I was first gathering stories.
As the first kind, yeah.
Yeah, when I first got was gathering stories for Cops True Stories of the Paranormal, I was told by a cop that he knew a guy who had a great UFO story, but I never got to make contact with that guy. So I was left with just my story, and then I conclude the section with a lot of mutilated cattle stories, which I find really fascinating. In fact, we researched it quite a bit, and I did a short story called Parts that was fun to write, and we learned a lot of stuff researching for the story, but stuff I didn't know even when I was working on the Cops True Stories. Okay, my incident happened, and this was the last thing on my mind. I didn't even think about UFOs or flying saucers or anything. Happened in the Florida Everglades. I talked to a chief of police down there, and he said, technically, I wasn't in the Everglades. I was on the edge of the Everglades. He said, but everybody calls it the Everglades. If you drive from Miami through Homestead out through the Keys, Key Largo is the very first Keys that you come to. You hang a hard left after entering the Keys and almost backtrack. In those days, it was just a single lane road that cut right through the jungle about 7 miles. I know it's 7 miles. I had to walk it a couple times. Each side of the road is just teeming with jungle. And when you get to a missile battery, I was stationed on a missile battery. There are four missile batteries, A, B, C, and D, around the Everglades. I never went to any of the other batteries. I was just at my battery, which was B battery, Bravo battery. If you went up 500 feet and looked down, you'd see a massive jungle with a little clearing to your right, and that's where our billet was, a little L-shaped concrete building there, concrete because of hurricanes. I was there during a hurricane. I'm glad it was concrete. Some radar dishes, but there's only 65 of us there. There were six of us who were military police with sentry dogs, German shepherds. And the rest were all missile guys, a couple of cooks, and a couple of clerical staff. A mile down this little one-lane road was another clearing about three times as large. I don't know if you can see my gestures or not. I'm talking with my hands here. About three times as large. In this space, and what did they just cleared? The bulldozers came in, they cleared this space, and we were constantly fighting the jungle who wanted to return and reclaim what has been theirs for many thousands of years. But there were three long rectangular barns that were actually missiles barns. Each barn held 6 missiles. I don't know how long the missiles were. I don't know, 50 feet. I don't know that much about missiles. I only saw them 2 or 3 times the whole time I was down there. And each one had 6 missiles. 2 of them were nuclear, and they're all aimed at Cuba.
Wow.
They were sprung up during the Cuban War. Mm-hmm. You know, we always came to World War III there. In fact, all 4 batteries were all aimed at Cuba, all the missiles. Around the barns was a double cyclone fence. It was about 12 feet high, barbed wire at the top. And a double, meaning there were 2 of them, with a little walking area, about a 6-foot wide walking area. It would go all the way around the barns. And that would, it was probably 3/4 of a mile. Off to one side were huge gravel berms, and these gravel berms were tons and tons of gravel was brought in. They were probably 30 to 40, 50 feet high, slanted, and with a flat surface on top about 6 feet wide. Those were there that in the event one of those missiles blew up, the force would go up and not wipe out the people of Key Largo. There was some trailers around. The trailers had radar dishes, just some other stuff that they used for the missile business. And there was a little ranch house there where you could go in, you could make some food or some bunks to sleep and a shoot pool and all that kind of stuff. Off to one side, right by the berms, was our dog kennels. We had 8 dogs in there, German Shepherds, all in separate kennels. We'd pick up our dogs at night, and we usually would work 2 at a time, and we'd just patrol that fence. We worked from 6 to 6 at night. Usually about 12 o'clock, 1 o'clock, we'd get bored, so we'd go up on top of the gravel berms. And if it was daylight, we'd be able to see about 1/4 mile of jungle and the ocean beyond it. And looking the other way, you'd see miles and miles and miles of ocean. Jungle. You'd never see the end of the jungle.
Hmm.
Way 35 miles to our east would be Homestead Air Force Base. I was in the Army, but the Air Force Base was about 35 miles. All these come into play here in a minute. I was there for 1 year, and about 6 months into my time there, we're up on the berms. Another dog handler and I were up on the berms, and we saw 3 bright lights in the direction of, it's kind of hard to tell direction because you couldn't see anything, but it'd be in the direction somewhere between the ocean and the mainland, somewhere fairly close to Homestead Air Force Base. And we saw the lights. They're about the size, at that point, that this first sighting, about the size of Venus at its brightest in whatever day that is, you know, a year. Very, very bright. And they were just kind of staying there. They weren't moving at all. And we're just looking at it going, what's that? The Air Force got, maybe they got choppers up or something. We didn't even thought in terms of mystical planes or any of that kind of stuff. We're Army grunts here. We didn't know anything about the Air Force. But and then it kind of started moving. Then they'd be still for a while and moving. And they were up there for 2 hours, and we just didn't think too much about it. We went down off the gravel, and we came back up later, and they were gone. Next night, maybe 2 nights later, we were back up there again, and there they were, another 3. And they were darting around a little more, moving out over what we thought were where the ocean was, and then moving back to where they had been. This went on for several weeks. And some nights there were more than 3. Some nights there were just 1. Some nights there was 5 or 6. And I just remember thinking, telling my buddies there, I said, you know, the air base is right there. They should be able to pick these up on a radar. If it's not them, they should be able to pick it up on a radar. So we told our superior officers, and they just said, we'll just keep write up a little report and keep us informed. I never got any feedback. I assumed they called the air base and told them what we were seeing. One night, my partner and I were walking the fence down one side, down the long portion, which is behind the barns. We were about halfway down, and we just stopped. I think my partner wanted a smoke or something. And we were just standing there talking, and for some reason, I looked up, and there were two lights way above us. How high they were, I no clue, because you don't know how big they are. Hmm. You know, maybe it came all the way down, they're just this big. You know? Yeah. But I'm assuming they were, you know, hundreds of feet up. And we had fence phones. We weren't supposed to use the fence phones for anything, unless we were being attacked by Cubans or alligators or something, you know. And I said, well, I said, an alien invasion is not a bad time to give them a call, you know. So I called and I said, we got a sighting of lights right overhead. And the captain says, hang up, stand by. And he called back about 3 minutes later and he says, you're going to see a show. And he hung up the phone. And we could hear jets coming from the airbase. Mm-hmm. And someone said they're interceptors. Again, I don't know anything about Air Force planes. I don't know if they're interceptors or what they were. But they were really moving really fast and just screamed overhead between us and the lights. And as they passed, the lights were gone.
And did you see them? Did you actually see them vanish? Or
no,
you just noticed them? They were gone.
It's gone. It either, you know, our theory, they either shot straight up or they just disappeared. Mm-hmm. We wrote a report. I'm assuming the captain wrote a report, didn't hear anything about it. And we were E4s in Army talk. That's like a corporal, if you don't know what an E4 is. That's like a worm in the military. So nobody's going to come and tell us what's going on. So we were hot one night, and we had four missile batteries, and each week one battery would be hot, and that meant all the missile guys would be down in the missile area. All the other 3 weeks, it was just us, the MPs. So we were hot, and so there were like 30 missile guys going and coming from the house to the missile barns, back and forth. And we didn't get our dogs out until real late because the dogs were just going nuts because all these guys were down there, you know, so we didn't bother getting them out. With dogs, it's all about following a scent cone. And when you got 30 guys down there, the dog's not going to get a scent cone or anything. So we just go in and shoot pool. One of the missile guys ran in at one point and he said they got a UFO on the radar screen. I don't know what they are now. In those days, where they were green with the little grids.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you had a UFO on there, the thing would blip. The thing would blip around.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And it would blip, and come back around again, and it probably whatever that takes 5 seconds, it would be down several grids. And we're all crowded in this trailer watching it, and somebody said, "How fast is it going?" And the guy turns around, he's just pale face. He said, it's got to be going at least 1,500 miles an hour, maybe faster, to cover those grids. Mm. The MPs were ordered to go back out. And I don't know if I was involved with anything after that, I don't remember it. Mm. But either that same week or the next month we were hot. Again, we were inside the shack shooting pool and watching TV and that sort of thing. Let me just back up a second. Again, we're in this this space, I don't know acres, but maybe 6 or 7 acres maybe, of cut out from the jungle. Hmm. In fact, we could hear crocodiles snapping their teeth on the other side of the fence sometimes. And the jungle was always alive with critter noise, you know, big critters. Yeah. Billions and billions of insects. The ground was always teeming with creepy, crawly stuff. I hated the place. I volunteered to Vietnam to get out of there. After the UFO thing, after enough of that, I said, send me to Vietnam. Yeah, BC's got to be easier, you know. But anyway, we're inside, and one of the guys ran, and he's all excited, and he says, there's something coming towards the barns. And so we all ran outside, and there were probably somewhere around 20 or 30 of us. And we had a new officer who was the duty officer that night. He was a warrant officer. And a warrant officer is some kind of weird rank between lieutenant and captain. But he was down there. I never saw him before. But we're all standing out there, and we're watching this light, big bright light again, coming from the jungle side of the area towards the barns. And it was coming in such a way that we could tell that it was descending, it was coming down. And it got closer and closer, and everybody was just really, really quiet. And then a couple guys got really excited and frightened. And somebody said, raise the missile bar, raise the missiles. Well, the missiles were ground to ground. They're not going to do any good. The ground to air, you know. But he was frightened and freaking out. Got closer and closer and closer. One part I left out of the story. Remind me when I finish this. I'll get back to it. He got closer and closer, and just as he was getting closer to the barn, just started taking a shape. And when you can see a shape, begins part of the close encounters of the second kind. It was going very, very slowly, humming in a V shape with a light. I remember a light on two sides. It might have had a light on all three sides, and it just crawled over us. I wrote my report that it was about 200 feet high. Some of the guys said 55. I don't think it was 50 feet high. And then somebody started screaming, and I turned around. It was a warrant officer. It had just gone nuts. These guys were trying to hold him. He's waving his 45 around. You know, I want to say, you know, dude, if they come from another planet, that 45 is not going to stop them, you know. They restrained him and pulled him into the shack. About 30 minutes later, a van came and took him away. Never saw him again. I don't know if he went to a mental institution or they just transferred him someplace. The object continued over the jungle towards the ocean and was out of sight. It was then that we noticed that the jungle sound was totally gone, which is another element of Close Encounters of the Second Kind. That the noise was, like I said, sometimes it'd almost be deafening. It was so loud. And it was absolutely quiet, and the dogs were quiet. All eight dogs, usually the dogs, like when the missile guys are down, they're going crazy all the time. The dogs were quiet, at which... I was a dog handler for 14 months, and I never heard the dog quiet. And so dog handlers and I ran out to the kennels. The kennels were sloped, cement runs, big fences between each dog because the dogs would kill each other. And at the end of the top of the slope was a doghouse sitting on a big telephone post, telephone-sized log, about 3 feet off the ground. And that's because of snakes.
Oh,
mm-hmm. And the dogs had defecated all over. Not the little pile like you pick up when you're walking your dog and you put it in. They said, blah, all over the place. I'd never seen that, all of them. And they were all in their doghouse, pushed back in a corner and just shivering. And my dog, Fritz was his name, he could sense when I was coming. And he'd just, yapping, the dogs changed to we have two dogs here at my house, and we call them the big boy bark when UPS guy comes to the door, and the yap when we come to the door. So they know. He didn't want to come out. I had to pull his 90-pound self out and carry him out into the grass and just hold him for a while until he started to return to normal. The part I left out happened about a month before this, and it was a boring night, and I was just dead tired. So I went to the kennel shack, which was next to the kennels, and I stretched out on the kennel, on the counter where we mix the dog food and all that kind of stuff. Little window there, little 20-inch by 20-inch window. It looked out in the direction of our living quarters a mile up the road, but we couldn't see it because it's just jungle. In the Everglades, the clouds sometimes are very strange clouds. I've only seen in the tropics. There's like little puffballs, and you have bare sky and then a puffball. And sometimes those puffballs would have their own little storm. And there, I was looking up, and there was this real spooky-looking kind of puffball in the sky between where I was and where the base was. And at one point, the outer edge of the cloud lit up like a fluorescent light, like a just a bar of light. And I go, whoa, and I kind of sit up, and then this light, this straight down, like this narrow to wide, hit the ground just once, and then whoop back up and disappeared. I jumped off the counter and ran outside, and the light was still gone, and the fluorescent light around the cloud was still there, and then it dissolved and disappeared. I thought the light had shined down on the where we lived, because we had some big radar dishes there, great big, you know, 100-foot-wide radar dishes there. But no one said up there said they saw anything, because they'd all been sleeping at that time of night. But we just wrote a report, and again, I didn't hear anything about it. So the next day after the big event, where it came right over us, the brass came out from Homestead Air Force Base and talked to us, and we got information. And there were some serious brass there, colonels, and they told us, well, we understand you had a little problem last night, you know, trying to play it down. And he says, just keep writing your reports. We're getting them. And don't shoot at them. And don't write home or don't call home and tell your family. And as soon as they drove off, we were all fighting over the one payphone, you know, for 60 of us. We were fighting over the phone, call home, tell our moms to get us out of there. And that and some other just creepy things that happened down there. I went in and volunteered for Vietnam, and to no surprise, I got it, you know. But
let's talk about now the craft that went over. When you said it was humming, that is really common. You hear that a lot when it comes to the triangle UFOs, because either they're silent or they're humming. You know what I mean? That's what
I hadn't heard that, because I hadn't followed any UFO stuff. I remember when I was a kid, there was a lot of stuff going on in the 50s. I remember my mother was real into it, but I never heard anything about triangles or noise or that light. Two or three years later, I was home. I went to a movie to see Close Encounters of the Third Kind with a buddy. And there's that scene where Richard Dreyfuss gets lit up with that kind of light.
At the railroad tracks,
The railroad tracks. And I remember, I think I literally stood up in the theater. I go, that's what I saw, to my buddy. And he's pulling me back down in the seat. And I said, that's it. That's what I saw. And so, you know, whoever wrote Close Encounters, I'm sure they did a lot of queries to people who have had experiences. You know,
oh, yeah.
They probably got that. They got that, you know.
Well, Steven Spielberg actually hired J. Allen Hynek. So there you go, right there.
Oh, the guy who
classified the guy that came up with the Close Encounters things. Yeah. So what about the lights? What kind of lights were there lights on the craft? And if so, what kind of lights were they?
Yeah, there were at least two in my memory. And I don't want my memory to fill in stuff that wasn't there. But I remember two lights. And I remember they weren't white, which would indicate to me they were must have been some kind of color. But I don't remember a color. And they're very small. The lights were very small. And the craft, for being as large as it was very large. Was going very slow. Lots of varies there, but it was very large and very slow.
And then you'd wonder how something like that would maintain altitude.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people will say, well, today when they see triangle UFOs, people say, well, they're probably some secret military project that we don't know about yet type of thing. But you're talking, this is 1969, right?
This is 67, yeah.
67,
We had prop planes, mostly. Not really. No, but they didn't have anything like that. I'm sure they didn't, so.
Right.
Well, I don't know. What do I know? I didn't know anything about the Air Force, so.
Yeah, it's hard to say. But back then, you know, I find it would be kind of strange if they'd have something like that that
and
was
not
ours.
Tell us, and not tell us. They caused a near panic. You know, and one warrant officer in particular and other guys were really super frightened about it. And then to shine a light down and then to come over our missiles, you know, you're trusting that Army guys aren't going to fire on you if you're coming right over our missiles.
Now, you called, I read your story and you called your parents and your mother was concerned for you, wasn't she?
Yeah, she was concerned because she was, you know, she followed UFOs back in the 50s. So that was, you know, 12 years earlier, she followed it. And I remember magazines laying around our house about UFOs and stuff, you know, really over the top stuff, but Men in Black and all that sort of thing. But she would just be concerned, but it's not like now where you can call your mother and they'll go to the congressman. In those days, you know, you're screwed, you know, you can't do anything like that. So, and she just said, oh, well, be safe. You know, I said, okay. So when I got to D.C. A couple months later, I saw a newspaper on a counter in one of the offices there. And there was a story about people in Miami, which was about 35 miles away, probably a little further, about 40 miles, sunbathing and a clear blue day. And they heard some really loud crackling up in the sky. And they all ran and were frightened. And there was never any follow-up. I didn't see any follow-up on the story at all. I was going to ask you, because you're more knowledgeable on this than I am. I have heard that some people believe that the Everglades are a really good place for UFO bases because they can just submerge in that swamp. You never heard that.
I don't know anything actually in particular about that. You know, our guest last week was talking about USOs, you know, submerged objects, but mostly in California. But I don't know about that in particular. I do know that Florida does have a lot of UFO sightings that and has for a number of years. There's a number of famous cases, controversial case there too, whether it really happened or not. But
I gave a talk to a group of paranormal enthusiasts here about 6 weeks ago at a place called Paranormal Pub, and it was a nice place, and it was they had some MUFON people there. And they asked the dates of my observation, which is kind of spread out, like over a 2 or 3 month period. But anyway, they went to some. I told them I can't remember now where I found it online, but I found a place online where some UFOs were observed in the Florida Keys in '69 when I was there. Or late '68 to '69, and then he went to another place and he found several. And I can't remember, I thought I wrote it down, but I can't remember. It was another website where you can just run your dates and they'll tell you where the sightings are and what happened, you know.
Yeah.
But it's pretty basic. It was just basically an entry that UFOs were seen there, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Not the young soldier boys are scared out of their wits. Nothing about that. So.
Well, it's funny because it's not, you're talking about, until you get out to Key Largo or whatever the key was you said there, you're in kind of a very low populated area where the military base was, right? I mean,
and
no
more
one
so
was out
more
there.
So now there's there was just jungle, and now I think it was about 10 years after this I was out of the Army and I had a 8-hour layover in Miami, so I rented a car, and I did a year in Vietnam, which wasn't a fun year, but I dreamt more about Florida than I dreamt about Vietnam. It's kind of strange, but I wanted to go back out and just kind of make contact with that place. And things have changed. You know, the road was, I think it was a 2-lane then. And I went out and I stopped at where the missiles were, and everything was in ruins now. The grass going up through the cracks of this cement and broken windows and stuff. But there's still a couple of MPs there. And they saw me at the fence and they came out, and, you know, what do you want? And I said, hey, you know, take it easy. I was here 10 years ago. And they go, oh, okay. And I said, can I come in and look around? They go, no. And, all right. So I said, okay, let me, I gave them a brief story of what happened. And I said, there's other things where we had some just bizarre experiences that we all felt. And I said, is anything, I didn't even get the question. I said, oh man, this place is really creepy. And we are so glad. I guess they're tearing it down the next day. Huh. And talk about luck. And he said, yeah, we're going to be glad to get out of here. And he said, the place is just really creepy. And I said, UFOs? And he just nodded. That's all he said. And then I saw a thing. I looked up the base online here a while back, and some of it's still there, but it's the jungle finally took it back. But you can see a little part of a radar dish sticking out here and a rooftop over here. And one of the buildings, and you know, I don't remember if it was Bravo Company, because I saw all four companies were virtually identical. Sometimes I thought I was looking at Bravo Company and was looking at A Company. But one building was called UFO headquarters or UFO building or something. So apparently, you know, some other people had experiences enough to name a building after it, you know. So
wow, that's something. Now, is that anywhere? Is that right off of like Alligator Alley that goes across that road that goes across the very bottom of Florida? Is it south of there? I'm just trying to picture where it is.
Key Largo is the very first Keys.
Oh, it is. It's actually on Key Largo.
Yeah, it's Key Largo, and you just enter. There's the Key Largo sign, and you hang a left, and it's probably it's not a 90-degree. It's probably a 100-degree turn, and you almost passing yourself, but kind of diagonally. And there was a resort. If this helps, it was a resort about, and I never got down there, 3 miles down from our military base that was owned by Jackie Gleason. And a couple of the guys worked down there working on sailboats and stuff. But
that's a character that was into UFOs. Jackie Gleason, I don't know if you knew that.
Oh, no. Well, maybe he saw it down there because that was his resort. He had to have $1 million, which was a lot of money back then, and $1 million to belong to it.
Oh, wow. Yeah. How about that? We have the line open if anyone wants to call in and ask a question. That number is up on the screen on YouTube right now if anyone would like to call in. If someone does call in, what I'll do is I'll take the call and just wait for a break. But if you are calling in, make sure you turn the volume down. You'll hear us, but make sure you turn the volume down on your computer. As far as that's the only sighting, I mean, not that wasn't a great sighting, but that's the only incidences that you had. We have someone actually calling in right now, so hang on. And it's a former police officer, I believe. Donnie.
Hey, Martin, how are you?
Good. Donnie has actually come in studio here a couple times. He has a place down on the lake right where I live here in Maine. So he's a former Boston police officer. Donnie.
Oh, nice to meet you.
Yeah. This is Lauren Christensen. Have you been listening to the show? You're in Guatemala, right, Donnie?
I am right now in Guatemala City. Yeah, I easily win the award for the longest distance caller of the night.
Yeah.
So far, yeah.
Hey, Lauren, I just want to say thanks. You know, I've seen some of your work about PTSD for police officers and wellness for police officers. And, you know, we come from a profession where, unfortunately, because of the stresses of the job and the things that we have to deal with and the horrors that we have to see, we don't tend to live very long after retirement. So
thanks for that.
For your work, you know.
Thank you very much. Great.
But I want to ask you. I saw you wrote a book about, you know, experiences that some of us within the brotherhood or sisterhood as well have had with these type of things. And I wanted to ask you, wouldn't it be a good idea, I mean, if somebody went out there and established a website for those of us, you know, the brothers and sisters in uniform, to be able to go someplace and report things that we've seen that we wouldn't normally report through regular channels? Something like aviators have NARCAP. I think it's NARCAP. Really nothing in the United States that I'm aware of. And Martin, you know, you would know better than I, but I don't think there's anything out there.
I thought about doing a Facebook page and then decided against it. But having a website, quite frankly, I never thought about that. I think it's a fantastic idea. You know, some of my buddies, when I talked about, told them I was going to do this Cops True Stories of the Paranormal. They told me, hey, you know, you got this reputation. You know, you wrote On Combat and a couple of these others that help cops, and you're going to ruin your reputation. And I talked to I'm sure you know Lieutenant Dave Grossman. I talked to him, my co-author, and he says, just do it. And and that was never an issue. And like, I don't know if you heard that from the very beginning, I had nothing but cops getting a hold of me, telling me their stories. I never asked why they wanted to tell the story, but my sense was they wanted to get it off the chest.
Nobody else that's going to listen to us, really, because if you go back to the station house, and you start to tell people what you saw, they're gonna yeah. chase you around with a butterfly net.
Yeah, you don't tell it at roll call, that's for sure. And one of the guys in the story, in the book, had an incident up in the Great Lakes. Actually, it was another vanishing story. And they didn't find a guy. The guy vanished right in front of him. He was right in his hood. And so the next day, all the guys at roll call, you know, they gave him a whole bunch of lip about it. But after everybody got in their cars and took off, one old-timer stayed behind and said, anybody that's worked this area long enough, they never drive that road. They only go up there if they're, you know, it's an accident or something, but they stay off that road because everyone has had experiences up there. So that's the kind of a deal where, like you said, you don't tell it at roll call. You just tell it to a couple of guys you know that are maybe sensitive to that kind of thing, but you're really opening yourself up to criticism. And some may believe you, but they're going to criticize you because that's just part of the nature of the beast with the police,
that's the nature of the job. You know, right, before I hang up and pass along to another caller, I just want to leave you with this last question. And that is, can you think of a case that's come to your attention, if, with the exception of the one famous one in the two famous ones in the Midwest, the one where the thing flew over the guy's car and actually creased over his UHF antenna? That's one that we can, you know, that's already out there. And the other one is the one that crossed over like southern Illinois into Missouri, and they chased it all over up and down different counties. And one guy even whipped out his traffic radar, clocked it on radar, doing about 40 some odd miles an hour. And it was a massive thing, whatever the hell it was. But can you think of any other police reported phenomenon that's come to your attention that might be worthy to share with us listeners? And I'll go ahead and hang up.
Okay. All right, Donnie, thanks for the call.
You bet.
All right.
Yeah, well, I've seen, probably like you, I've seen them on some of the paranormal shows, and to include reenactments. I have got a story that I'll put in the second book. I hope I can do it. I got the story. I told the guy it's great. I filed it, and I haven't looked at it for a while. So just in the essence of it is a UFO passed over the guy, over the cop. He chased it, and another car joined in. That officer quit not too long after, and they chased it for some distance. They got up to 80, 90 miles an hour, and then it made it a bam. It just went right back the other direction. And they, by the time they could turn around, they had lost it. So that story, probably with some additional details that I can't recall right now, because I wasn't going to talk about it, but that one would be in the second book. But that's, in fact, I was trying to remember if the guy had a radar or not, but he said that he was doing 90 miles an hour, so I would think that would indicate that he didn't have a radar. If he's doing 90, and I think your caller said 40 miles an hour, so my guy had a faster chase.
Well, 40 miles an hour is odd because how can something stay airborne? You know,
right?
That's the thing that's really odd about that. So that was Sheriff Val Johnson, that incident. I don't know if you've ever heard about that.
Oh.
In Minnesota, it was actually. You've heard of it?
If it's been on some of those shows, they probably did.
Yeah,
and I don't remember the names. You know.
Yeah, that's right. So the lines are open if anyone else wants to call in, and also I'll try to glance at chat to see if there's any questions up on there. So if you had to, guess on what these things actually are. And I want to talk about, first of all, you have some experiences in your the writers of this book that sent in stories had some ghost experiences. But have you ever pondered what these? Well, we actually have a call coming in. Are you ready to take another call?
Sure.
All right. Here we go. Caller, your first name and where are you calling from?
Hey, it's Bobby from North Carolina. Hey, Martin.
Hey Bobby. How you doing?
Hi, Bobby.
I'm doing great. First of all, I wanted to thank Mr. Christensen for his service.
Thank you.
My brother was 82nd Airborne during Vietnam, but he got lucky. and stayed back in Fort Bragg and Fort Benning training troops. He made sergeant and just trained, so he never actually made it over there.
Very good.
But you were talking about the private island back off Key Largo. And I actually did some work there after Hurricane Andrew. I was out there repairing screen rooms and patio rooms, and that place was absolutely amazing. They had a gatehouse the size of a house with six guys, so you couldn't even get on the island unless you had business there or you owned a home there. You could not even go out there. But I wanted to mention, Martin brought up Jackie Gleason's story. You said you hadn't heard that. Jackie Gleason would actually golf with Nixon, President Nixon. And one night, President Nixon actually drove to his house and picked him up and said, get in. And he took him to Homestead Air Force Base. And they went somewhere underground on the base. And the story is that Nixon showed him, like, pickled alien bodies in, like, glass containers and wreckage of a UFO.
Wow.
And Jackie Gleason came home that night and was all white and pale and just... He'd already been following UFOs. I think he had a whole library on UFOs at the time, and told his wife that story. So it's something you may want to look up, because that's really
interesting. Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting.
I've wondered, lived in Miami.
Bobby, before you move on in that story, has anyone ever recorded Jackie Gleason actually telling that story, or is that a hearsay type of thing?
It's kind of hearsay, but it's supposed to be, it supposedly came from his wife. Now, when they divorced, divorced.
Yeah.
There, she was kind of angry about things, so she may have redacted what she had said. But I believe the story originated from her.
Yeah, that's right. I did hear that. Yeah, I did hear that. Yeah.
But I lived in Miami. I was born in Miami, and I lived down there in South Florida till I was about 30 years old. And all the UFO stuff that I've seen, all the crazy stuff that I've seen actually all happened in South Florida and Kendall.
So. Now, Andrew was the one that hit in 64, 65, something like that?
No, 92.
Okay.
Yeah, Andrew's actually really, really bad. I missed a lot of it because I had no power for 3 months. But it literally looked like a war zone. All the trees had no leaves. Uh-huh. The limbs were stripped off. And then towards Homestead and Naranja Lakes, that whole area was literally devastated. It was about every building had severe damage to it. So... anyways, thank you for your service, and great show. I'm enjoying it.
All right, thanks.
All right, Bobby, thanks for the call.
All right.
So I was going to ask you what you thought the possibility, when you saw that craft that floated over you, like slowly floated over you, and the humming and all that, what did you and your buddies actually think? Did you talk about it, and what did you think? Did you think it was... most likely not from this earth, or what did you talk about, or did you talk about it?
Yeah, we talked about it, and I think when I initially saw the thing going over, I keep telling myself it's a plane, and then I would go self. If it's a plane, shouldn't it have wings? You know, there's no wings, but I was kind of in a denial thing. It's got to be some kind of a plane, but then it's going too slow. And then seeing everybody, so it wasn't just me kind of, you know, what is this? Is 30 other guys all reacting to it also. And then after it passed over and the officer wigged out, which really added to it, then we started noticing other things, the silence, the absolute dead silence that we hadn't heard. At that point, like I said, I'd been down there about 7 or 8 months. I think I've been down there longer. I want to say that happened in January of 69. So at that point, I'd been there about 7 or 8, 9 months. And so this was so out of the norm for this jungle to be quiet. And for those dogs, I worked with dogs in Texas, and then I worked with dogs in the Everglades, and the dogs don't, with the same dog. And I knew that dog as well as I know my old household dogs here. He didn't act that way. And for all 8 of them to act the same way, and for the billions of insects and creepy crawlies to just become totally silent, that added to my thoughts that this has to be. Because planes were going over, we weren't that far from the airport. So planes were going over all the time, high, because we were some distance from the airport, but never that low. Never saw one that low before. So all these things kind of changed kind of washed away that denial I had. And, you know, we talked about, and there were some other sightings after that. There, we still saw some lights darting around, but nothing that came close like the ones that were directly overhead, or another incident where it flew directly over us. And then I left in May of 69, went to D.C. for 3 months, learned Vietnamese, and then went over to Vietnam. So, yeah. And then I said, then later, I think I read some articles about Florida and sightings, and then that little somebody's theory that, you know, when you fly over the, well, you probably, I'm sure you have flown to the Everglades. There's, you look down, it's there's these circles of brush or trees or something, almost look like craters, and with water in the middle. And I remember flying over there thinking, gee, a UFO could indeed just slip right underneath there, slip right back out, and
they get kind of muddy, though.
Yeah,
it's very muddy there. Yeah,
and now it's full of pythons.
Yeah, and alligators. So, why don't you tell? Now, I know you talked a little bit in your book about cattle mutilations, which is another bizarre thing. But you actually had some type of experience, and with your wife, you were searching. You were going to do something with ghosts, and so you started looking into that topic. And you had some type of cold spot or something. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, I suppose it's sort of minor compared to what you see on television. But I was talking to my my book agent, and we were talking about a whole other matter, and we were just getting ready to hang up. And he said, would you be interested in doing a book on Ghost Hunters, a TV show? And I go, yeah. He said, you know much about it? And I go, sure. Just, you know, you lie when you apply for a job. I go, sure. And so we hung up, and I told my wife, I said, yeah, I might be doing a book on ghost hunters. I said, let's start. And we were already interested in it. We watched all the shows and stuff, you know, but and we had a couple of books. And so we got more books and watched more shows. And then we went to a ghost hunters group one night, and they were just too weird for us, you know. I don't want to hang out with these people. And so we got a digital camera, and we got a EVP recorder, electronic voice phenomena recorder, and a thermometer device. And there's a lot of haunted places in Portland, but, you know, we're new at it. We didn't know, what do you just knock on a door, you know, can we come in and talk to your walls and see if anybody wants to talk to us, you know. So we didn't. So we said, well, let's just go to graveyards, you know. And I've read where some people say, you don't go to graveyards because if you're a spirit or a ghost, you're not going to hang around the graveyard. But who knows? Nobody's an expert at this stuff. And my theory was, I mentioned a book that Willie Horton was a prolific bank robber in the 30s, robbed hundreds of banks. Probably dozens, but he wasn't good. He kept getting caught, and he'd go to prison for a couple of years, get out, and start robbing banks again. Finally, a reporter said, why do you rob banks, Willie? He says, because that's where the money is. So we said, well, let's go to the graves, because that's where, you know, the dead people are. So we went to a couple of graveyards. But Portland has some fantastic ones. They have one really, really spooky one. In fact, the pictures I took for that kind of salted in the book are ones that we took at some of the graveyards. And it just happened to be a foggy day too. So we just got one thing at a graveyard. It was a freshly buried person with flowers on top. And we just got a wisp of smoke, some kind of wisp of cloudy substance coming up from the flowers into the air, whatever that was. We don't know. But we discovered a mausoleum, and Portland has a lot of mausoleums, like any big city, but it has an incredible mausoleum that was big to begin with, and it looks like a building that's been added on to and added on and added on to. Apparently, the first carpenters didn't think that more people would die than, you know, but they just kept adding on to it, adding floors, adding basement. I think it was 3 or 4 stories high and a couple, 3 stories low. A monstrous place. And we found our way into it. There wasn't anybody else in it. I think we saw one car out. You still there?
Hello?
Uh-oh. Oh, I'm sorry. I took the call, but I was going to have them on hold. But are you willing to take the call now, and we'll go back into the story?
Sure. We can do that.
Sure. All right. Sure. Sorry to interrupt you.
No problem.
Caller, sorry, I lost you. Your first name, where are you calling from?
This is Steve. I'm in New Hampshire. How you doing?
Hi, Steve.
Welcome to the show. You have a question for our guest?
No, I have an experience that he might relate to, because in the 60s and 70s in Europe, there were Nike Hercules spaces, and I was assigned to one in the early and mid-70s in Italy. And the setup was, we had three missile barns. Two of them had what they call special weapons or classified weapons in them, and we had a guard force that provided security for them. And one night I was a duty officer, and I went downrange, and we had four guards down in the shack there. And they said, "Wow, you missed it, LT." And I said, "What?" And they said, we had this thing over one of the missile barns." I said, "Well, what do you mean a thing?" And they said, it's there, you see it?" And in the distance I could see a white glowing thing. And I says, "Oh, that's a satellite or something." And they said, no, it was closer. And one of the sergeants there said, "Well, I hope we don't see one of those things again." I says, "Well, what are you talking about?" Well, he was in Greece in a similar site that had special weapons. And one night he said a large glowing object came over one of the missile barns, and it was so close that it set off the alarm system, which, you know, those wow. barns were armed and everything. And it set it off. And the duty officer came down, they put it in the report and the whole bit. And the next day, a team came out from CTAF, which was like the regional headquarters of the Southern European Task Force. And they questioned all of them, told them not to talk about it, and they broke them all up and reassigned them. And this sergeant got sent to the site we were at in Italy. So that was, many years ago, but it just, wow. when you were about the Nike Herc bases, and I had heard since then that there were a lot of UFOs over places that had nuclear or classified weapons stored, and I just thought I would pass that wow. along.
Great thank story, you. Steve. Thanks for the call.
Yes, thank you guys. Keep it up.
All right.
Enjoy this.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right, so before the call came in, we were actually talking about the mausoleum you and your wife were in. I apologize for the interruption there.
No problem. Okay. I thought I actually lost you there. It's a monstrous mausoleum, three stories up, three stories down, with tens of thousands of marble drawers in which the deceased lay, and little alcoves, glass-covered alcoves, in which there were vases of ashes. Mm-hmm. And marble floors. So you could hear water dripping somewhere, and your imagination. You have to be careful that you don't have a wish fulfillment or something. You know, and you want to find something, and you do.
Is this a dark place or is it lit?
It's lit, but it's just poorly lit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so my wife had a digital, and so she just went around snapping digital, trying to get an orb. And I'd walk around my little voice recorder going to hold it up to your drawers. Anybody want to talk to me? We didn't know what we were doing. And we did that we were probably there for 3 hours. It's a pretty fascinating place. And it had spooky angels, you know, of
carvings,
statues of, carvings, yeah. Not real angels. And just a real creepy place. And we left and we went home, and I hooked my EVP recorder up to the computer, and we didn't get anything. But we decided to go back the next week, and we went back the next month, the next week. And again, wife took off snapping pictures, and I just sat on a bench. I'd kind of lost interest already. And we were there probably about 90 minutes. She came back. And she said, "I feel awful." And she said, "I'm just totally, totally exhausted, depleted. Like I just want to curl up on this bench here and sleep." And I had just gotten grumpier and grumpier. And I just wanted to punch somebody. I said, "Well, let's just leave." And it got worse as we got about halfway home. At first it got worse as we left. And then about halfway home, it was about a 40-minute drive home. It started to lessen. But I've never felt just you know, I've gotten mad at somebody, but never just out of the blue, just this rage. And my wife, who's no more energetic than she is, and just to get just wilt into a pile. And we got back to the house and we just sat out in the driveway. We didn't want to go into the house. If we, he said, maybe we picked up something. My son is a pastor, and he said, don't mess with that stuff. Don't mess with that stuff. This stuff will cling to you, you know. And so we stayed in that. We had a symphony to go to that night, but we stayed in the car for probably 30 minutes, 25, 30 minutes, and until we felt better, good enough to go in the house and go to the concert. But we were kind of dragging at the concert, and we never went back out there again. Went to a couple more cemeteries, went to another mosque. It's just a real small one. It probably had 100 people in it, 100 deceased in it, L-shaped. And my wife was went down one end, and I didn't take my EVP thing. I felt kind of stupid talking to drawers, you know. But I took the temperature thing, and I just sat down on a bench and just waited for her to get her pictures. And she didn't get any images, orbs. She didn't get any orbs at the big mausoleum at all. And so I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden, I started getting really cold. And I look around. There's no windows in the place, of course. There's no vents. And I look at my temperature thing. It dropped about 10 degrees. And instantly. And my wife, I could hear her getting, I could hear the clicks getting louder and louder as she was getting nearer and nearer. She came around the elbow of the L-turn there. And she looked at me, and she saw whatever my face was doing, and I said, take a picture of me. I just kind of mouthed it. She took a picture, and it was the only picture we got an orb. She took hundreds, a giant orb by my chest.
And, really, but you couldn't see it. What type of camera was she using?
Digital is what they recommend, and now you have everybody's got cell phones. Cell phones will probably work pretty well.
So it was just a regular camera. It was nothing special. But you couldn't see it with your eyes, but you could see it on the camera.
No.
Was there any light behind you or anything that could have caused a lens flare?
No. You always rule out dust and that sort of thing. That's always a possibility. But this place was pretty spotless. No strange light. It wasn't raining outside. We took a picture for the cover of Cops, True Stories of the Paranormal. There's a house. You can barely see it in the fog. That's a real spooky house. And we talked when we were shooting pictures for the book. We got orbs, but it was raining. So we just wrote that off as rain orbs. Supposedly there's different, you can tell by if it's a dust or the rain, water or something. There's a series of pubs, and the one where I gave a talk to a couple several weeks ago is one of them that are haunted in Portland. One of them was a poor farm where people who were poor were put in this farm way back in the 1890s or whatever. And you can go out there with the digital, and people have, and there's a long hallway down this hotel, and you take pictures, and there'll be 50 or 100 orbs in the pictures.
Weird.
Yeah. Wow. And are they something? Who knows? A lot of paranormal experts, and you know, say that orbs don't mean anything, and other experts say, yeah, they mean a lot. It could be, you know, a ghost trying to manifest itself, or that sort of thing.
Well, a number of people have talked about orbs having sort of an intelligence to them, you know, so in the way they navigate and stuff like that. So I don't know, you know, there
is sometimes sometimes pictures are capture orbs in pictures where there is a haunting. So that would be significant in my mind. I am not an expert. I wrote this book as a reporter and a guy who's had three or four experiences. So,
yeah. Now, in your book, you talk about cattle mutilations, and that's another bizarre thing happening. And there's, you know, skeptics will say Satanists. I saw you wrote that in your book and a number of different things, but a lot of things just don't add up. And one thing you did write in there was about the possibility of them being dropped, and which came to mind a couple of them that I've heard about. I don't know if you ever heard of the Skinwalker Ranch, but there was a mutilation where the cow's head was like stuck in a hole as if it had been dropped from above, and like it went down and, you know, smashed into a hole. Bizarre things.
And sometimes they're dropped through trees, and they, really? They hit the ground, and they hit the ground so hard they leave an imprint. They bounce over to another location, a couple 3 feet away, and you can look up and you can see all the limbs broken all the way to the top.
I don't think cows climb trees, as far as I know.
Nope, they don't. They don't. And then there's always people talking about the black helicopters and all that sort of thing, and or the governments behind it. Where, as I mentioned in the book, as a guy who worked in the government, in the army and the police, two people can't keep a secret, you know, and there's that. And the other thing is, why would a government go to a hardworking farmer, take his cow and go and slice it up and then bring it back and drop it off? You know, surely they can buy their own cows, and they, or if they do steal a cow, they can just throw it in an incinerator someplace. Why bring it back and make the guy feel even more miserable? But what was kind of interesting is some of the mutilations, you know, there's certain similarities that the mutilations, usually the sex organs are cut out, the udder if it's a cow, the eyes, sometimes the mouth. And most of the time, there's no blood anywhere. There's no blood on the ground. The nature of the soil has been changed, like just like some of the UFO sightings where UFOs have landed. They've tested the ground, and the ground is different. Or there's kind of a charred mark around the animal. Or one thing I found really interesting, they found one cattle mutilation in, you see, the late 50s, early 60s, and it had, and most of them have a precision cutting. So it's not like an animal gnawed it, you know. The precision cutting of whatever they want, the sex organ or the udder or whatever. The instruments that were used, the experts at the scene looked, and they said that the instruments that were used would not be invented. They looked at pictures. Would not be invented for another 10 years.
Wow.
I think that's pretty pretty awesome.
And the surgical type cutting, you know, there's a, you know, I mean, you talk about looking at evidence, but we'll talk about that in just a minute. We have a call coming in, so I'll take that. Hi, caller. You're on the line. Can you tell us your first name and where you're calling from?
Yes, this is Andy from Stratford, Connecticut.
Hi, Andy. Can you please turn your computer mute, please?
Yep. Got it.
All right. You have a question? Go ahead.
Yeah, it's not a cattle mutilation, but it really made me wonder. In the woods in central New Hampshire a few years ago, was out hiking alone, and deep in the woods, not near any roads, certainly not near any kind of a road where a vehicle could get, you know, maybe a dirt bike or a hiker, I saw, far from any path, a deep, perfectly round area of soil where it looked like a giant ice cream scoop came in and just removed a perfectly round piece of the earth. I would say maybe 4 feet, 5 feet in diameter and about 2 or 3 feet deep. And it wasn't on a hill where it would have been a rock that rolled away. And I just stood there for a while staring at it, and I could not figure out how that came to be there. And a little while later.
Pardon me, did you actually see where the dirt went, like piles of dirt around it? Or
That's just what made the whole thing just so bizarre. Like, nothing I was looking at made any sense to me. There was no dirt. There was no rock. There were no tracks for a bulldozer or a backhoe. There was no way that soil shouldn't be gone. And I took me a while to try to process it. I just shook my head and filed it away. And then years later, when I started hearing about cattle mutilations, and it made me wonder if something was taken away right there, or I'll never know. But that was something I can't figure out, and it stuck with me for years. And on a separate note, I live near and work near the Pease Air Force Base.
Oh, yeah.
For years and years and years, and was never had any luck seeing anything there. But at one point in the military training at Indian Town Gap in Pennsylvania, myself and a couple other guys on night patrol, not everybody saw it, just a few of us together, saw lights blinking in and out, moving across the entire horizon, so covering hundreds and hundreds of miles just in a few seconds, and then changing direction sharply. And we didn't really talk about it and didn't tell our superiors. We knew that it would go nowhere. It definitely would have been frowned on.
It could go somewhere, but you would never know.
Yeah, true. Yeah. I won't rehash the whole story, but I saw a green orb in the military training at Ethan Allen Firing Range in Vermont, and plain as day right in front of me with another person. And we did tell a few people, and we were totally told to keep quiet, don't bother. Mm-hmm. And that was easily the biggest mind blower I've ever seen in my life.
Wow.
Anyway, that's it. I just wanted to share that soil story.
Sure.
Is
thank you.
My favorite. All right.
Thanks for the call.
Good show, guys. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, thanks for the call. I actually grew up across the river from Pease Air Force Base, and I remember when there was a fighter jet crash there, our whole house shook. That's a military base right in Newington, New Hampshire. But I lived across the river in Maine.
All right.
Okay, thank you for the call.
Yeah, that's great. That place is nuts. When the galaxy, C5A galaxies come and go, they can be a half a mile away, and you can't hear yourself think.
Right.
So, anyway.
All right. Thanks
good,
for the call.
Good show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. You know, I don't remember what we were talking about. I was just asking you a question, I believe, when he called in. But we're getting right near the end of the show. We got about 6 or so minutes left. We were talking about cattle mutilations, basically. It is bizarre that, you know, the no blood thing and the, people have said, well, it's a soft tissue that the animals get in and, you know, eat away and stuff like that. But the precision cutting, I've seen pictures, it's really bizarre.
In some cases, the indigenous animals, birds, won't go near it. To pick at the carcass. And I remember a couple of stories where they didn't go near for 30 days.
Wow.
They'd hang on a wire like they were waiting, but they didn't go near it for 30 days.
Isn't that bizarre? When you wrote your book and your book came out, you said it was on the bestseller list. Did you have police officers contact you, you know, through Facebook or somehow through your website? About their story, they say, gee, I wish I would have known, you know, you're going to do that or anything like that for like a follow-up?
Well, yeah, I'd like to do a second one. In fact, most of the reviews ask for a second one. I'll put a word out and I'll get a couple, which, you know, can't make a book out of. I think I have like 6 right now. Can't make a book out of that. And then I won't hear anything for a while. So I just get busy on. I usually have 2 books going at the same time. So I'm working on something else. But I have a guy. I've been trying to get him to tell me a story. As he was a policeman and responded to a call in the real house in which the movie The Exorcist was based on. And he had an experience in that house with a cat. other guys have sent me, I have 3 or 4 but I feel bad because I've been holding on to them. And so if any of your listeners are police, you got stories, you know, give me a shout. And I'd like to do another one. Because this is so well received and several of the writers told me how good they felt after they wrote the story and they could finally get it out there. Now, I thought most of the officers would want not to use their real name, but only 3. They are still currently on a PD, and their agency didn't want them to use their name, and they didn't want them to use their agency. So I just say, a West Coast city or something. But all the rest of them, they're real names and real police agencies. And So it was a very very informative and sometimes kind of a spooky book to work on. It was a fun one to work. And I wasn't sure how it was going to be taken because, like your one caller said, you know, I have a rep out there with Army and military on writing books on PTSD and that sort of thing. And they go, this guy's gone off the deep end, but it never got that at all.
Have you done other books as well where you have like a cooperation like you did with these writers?
Yeah. I have a book called Warriors. It's out of print now. On combat, I did with an Army colonel, and that's the biggest one I've written. And we worked. It took us 30 months to write that one.
Wow.
And yeah, and it's required reading at the War College and different military units and that sort of thing. Yeah, so we got a lot of input from guys who had stories. It's on what happens to your body in a toxic, violent situation, war, you know, in particular. It's for or a shooting. It's for police officers and military, and it's how to prepare your mind for it, how to prepare it as it happens, and the worst for most people is how to prepare your mind for the aftermath. So a lot of people just contributed their stories to that book. So that was kind of nice. But the paranormal book was, I really wanted to do something different, and that worked out. The cop's true stories of the paranormal worked out really well. So
yeah. Well, it looks like we're at the end of our time here, and it's been a real pleasure. I really enjoyed tonight's show a lot.
So, thank you.
And thanks so much. All right. So that was our guest, and very enjoyable. And he has a website. You can check that out. And that is actually his name. And so... that's it for the show. I want to thank everyone for listening, and I want to thank the supporters that support the show. Next week, we have Peter Robbins coming up, and he will be, he's a friend. I did want to tell Lee Spiegel's story because it was involved with, he had a UFO over him. A number of our listeners have heard it many times, but he was with a lot of police officers when that happened. I didn't get a chance to tell that, but anyway, Lee will be coming up in a while on another show, but again, thanks so much for listening, and we'll be back next week. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.